Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. On this week's film review, we have Youthful Commander's Sailing Adventures and middle-aged wannabe rock stars. Is this the making of a good weekend at the cinema? Well, to find out, I'm joined in the studio by critic Jason Solomons. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Hi, Ben. Nice to see you.
Always. Now, we'll begin today with the childhood of Alida, where we meet a 9-year-old son of an American diplomat living in France after the First World War. The film follows the child who descends into a little bit of madness and who will eventually become a dictator at the end of the next war. Let's hear a clip.
Please.
He's been acting out of it.
He's only a little boy. He didn't actually hurt anyone, did he?
I'm sorry, Mama.
Why would you want to hurt anyone?
Do you like it here?
Why don't you lead us in a prayer, my love?
No.
Hold your hand up.
Now, that musical score, Jason, I mean, look, we'll discuss the film in detail, obviously, but first, that musical score that we heard there just in that little clip, it sort of exists as its own character, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, perhaps dominates the movie. It is by Scott Walker, we should add. So any people might know Scott Walker. I think the Walker brothers, Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore, then went on to have this kind of reclusive career and then reemerged as a kind of avant-gardist doing Jacques Brel things and now is a sort of film composer. And this is, I suppose, his most kind of complete film score, and it is baroque and fantastic and dominating and, you know, nerve jangling. It's got a bit of Bernard Herrmann in there, but it's got a bit of Johnny Greenwood, if you like, as well. I mean, it's terrific. I mean, to the point where the director, Brady Corbett, has clearly kind of commissioned this score, got this thing back from Scott Walker and thought, oh, God, I'm going to use this. I mean, it's every note's in there. It's often to the point drowning out the dialogue.
So that's
some respect from a director who wrote this dialogue and has sort of said, well, I'm going to play this music over it because it's
absolutely
so fantastic.
I mean, I would describe it as audacious. It is audacious use of music, and I think a lot of filmmakers would probably get that and think, oh, I can't possibly use this. I mean, this is just too over the top. And I know critics often criticize composers with the music that they create for a film that becomes too overbearing. And I know Philip Glass often gets criticized for that, for the music standing out too much. And I mean, the music is out and proud.
Yeah, Michael Nyman used to get it in the way. John Williams sometimes now gets it for Spielberg. It's like, it's too syrupy, it's too much strings, it's too much warhorsey thing, telling you what to think. But this score doesn't do that. It doesn't really tell you what to think, apart from like, oh my God, something's happening here.
Yeah, it warns you against assuming too much, I think.
Yeah, it's a harbinger. I think it's a really fine piece of work that I think the score must have been done. Often scores are done in isolation. Alexandre Desplat writes it on a plane and sends it over and people just go, oh, that's great, it's Alexandre, we're going to get an Emmy for it. This is proper collaborative, I think, working with it, because it's such a key character in the movie. And it's got a kind of blend, as the movie is, it's a blend of kind of horror and family drama and politics as an archive film. It's a very strange film, Childhood of Alida, by Brady Corbett, who was a child actor, a young actor, then went off to Paris and sort of decided that he liked it there. And in that kind of classic American way, that he's kind of a bit like, oh, Paris, the Left Bank, Gitans, Berets. It's a little bit like, oh, I'm such an art house darling now.
I mean, the film is, I mean, look, I know when you walked into the studio today, I said, in a word, what is your impression of The Childhood of Alida? And your first word was ambitious. And indeed, it does feel like that. I mean, Brady Corbett, if people are aware of who he is, they would probably know him from films like Mysterious Skin being the most artistically relevant film,
yeah,
I think he did as an actor.
He was in Michael Haneke's Funny Games, which he remade
indeed,
sort of shot for shot.
He was in that terrible version of Thunderbirds as well. Although he did his performance was very fine in that, let's be clear.
No wonder he left. To make movies, you know, if you're in that Thunderbirds movie, what a flop! And, you know, he's like, you know what? I'm out of here. I'm make my own films.
So really, if we were to compare those two, for whatever reason, I mean, this is a world away. The tones here, the color tones, are very, very. How would you even describe it?
It's shot by a British cinematographer called Lowell Crawley, who's done a lot of good work in the indie sector, but it has really come here, I think, that sort of painterly lighting, that they look sort of, you know, they're almost kind of Goya-esque, some of the lighting, or Velasquez, at least. They're very interiors. It's about a little kid kind of shut away in a country house while his dad's away negotiating the Treaty of Versailles in 1918. Now, my cursory knowledge of history, it's one of the flawed documents of history, the Treaty of Versailles, and that gave rise to people, to Hitler, basically. It was so punitive on Germany that it gave rise to austerity and Hitler. So that's what's happening sort of while that's going on in the background. This kind of kid is you know, the father's absent, the mother's a little bit kind of distant. He kind of takes his revenge on the governess, played by Stacey Martin. He's the kind of malevolent child in the kind of Damien Omen meets Chucky the doll kind of way. And those creepy kids always creep me out. And he does very well, played by Tom Sweet, as a 10-year-old London kid. I think he's 11 now.
Interesting that you should point out the comparisons to those horror films, The Omen and so on, because I know I had a chat to Brady Corbett for The Cinema Show this week, and I asked him about the comparisons to those other films, because I know there are hints at it, but watching the film, it's clearly very, very separate to that. And he was quite open with the fact that really those comparisons happened because it made it easier to get the film made. You know, you can say that this is a political film, but it's really about it's blending real life dictators with the kid from The Omen, and that allows you to actually get the film.
So
made.
It
exists separately.
Oh no, absolutely. I mean, the kid doesn't have any superpowers. I mean, they always say when you're parenting, you know, the contented baby, don't let your child run the household, or he will become a dictator. They use that phrase in parenting, and he will dictate the methods of the household, and that's what happens here. They have kind of neglected the kid, so the parents are to blame. And I suppose that's what the political metaphor is, that if you sort of neglect one area of society, it will squeeze out and have an effect somewhere else. And that's the sort of the pulse of 20th century history. Now, I can see as Brady's trying to pitch that, and yeah, I'm going to have this score from Scott Walker, and it's going to be shot like a, you know, like a Delacroix painting. So I think you can see that there's a lot of ambition in this portrait. It's also about ambition, because the child has got his eyes set somewhere in the future, certainly not the present. And the dad's off trying to kind of, you know, curry favour and bring societies together and heal wounds with Woodrow Wilson's government. So it's a very unusual film. The archive film of the Treaty of Versailles that pops up is fascinating to see too. I'd never really seen that stuff with all the French kind of out Vive Wilson in their banners. Fascinating movie. I think what we call it flawed, because I by the end I was like, I don't really know what's going on here. I don't quite know when it ended. I was like, I don't like to spoil the ending because it's quite big. I was like, I don't really know what's just happened there. We've just seen the birth of fascism, but I don't quite know who is doing it. When you see the film, which I really think you should, there's a lot of it. There's a lot of flashy camera movements, as if Brady Corbett's gone, oh, I'm a director, I can do this now. Hey, look, whoa. And he just flips it around and does a tracking shot where there's no need for it.
I think the ambiguity works as much in its advantage as it does work against the film as well, because it does. You do walk away from the film with this knowledge that you've seen something that is very important, that is saying that's saying something quite ambitious, as you would say, but its ambiguity means that you can't really apply it to anything too specific, so it leaves you with as much confusion as it does clarity.
I think all the baroqueness of the score, and Berenice Bejo as the mother, who's terrific as well, and all that kind of ambition ultimately clouds the clarity of what the
Absolutely.
Message might be of the film. But definitely, I think, as you said, if Freddie Corbett made another movie, you'd go and see it and wait with interest what he does next.
Exactly. And he's only 28 years old. It's absolutely astonishing.
Hate him.
So exactly. It does make you feel rather unaccomplished, doesn't it? So that is Brady Corbett's The Childhood of a Leader, which is out now in the US and right here in the UK as well. And you can hear my interview with Brady Corbett on today's edition of The Cinema Show. That's at 2000 here in London. Download the podcast. Now we'll visit a childhood classic, an entirely different kind of childhood, let's be clear. Now, you may have read Arthur Ransom's family adventure Swallows and Amazons, and now BBC Films has put it back on the big screen after a first production back in the 1970s. Jason, first, remind us of the storyline behind Swallows and Amazons.
Whenever anyone talks about Swallows and Amazons, they say, oh, it's the beloved book by Arthur Ransom. I have to say, I was given this book to read at school. Not beloved by me.
Weren't a fan of it.
I mean, it opens.
I hadn't
with this,
heard of it, to be honest.
Well, it's a sort of British classic. I mean, it's so British, and it's British classic Britishness. You know, it's all about these kids who go off from the London. They go off on a steam train, and they tack up, and they go to the Lake District. They put up tents, and they go to an island, and they kind of get involved in sort of skullduggery that's going on with some spies and grown ups.
I'm guessing you're actually not much of a camper.
I'm not
yourself.
An outdoor kind of guy. You know, my people are not seafaring people. Ben, they had to wait for the the Red Sea to part before they would cross it. I don't get on boats readily, and knots and sails are not my thing. So I was never a big Swallows and Amazons. You know, the Swallows is one of the boats that the kids get in, and then the Amazons is another boat for the other kids on the island who pretend to be pirates are. So it's a rival gang thing. That's Swallows and Amazons. And it's about these kids whose parent, whose father is away on a destroyer ship, because we're in 1935 kind of era. And they go to the Lake District, and their mum says, oh, you can go to that island in the middle of the lake and spend the night there in a tent. Well done, you can go there. But they do that, and they sort of see some Rafe Spalls on a houseboat there, and they kind of, and he's being spied on by some Russians led by Andrew Scott, who is always playing some kind of spy master these days. He needs to get a different role, I think. As good as he is at it. And then they become pesky kids, and they kind of get away of the sky. It's a bit Famous Five-y, if you know that stuff. What this does is lashings of British charm, really, on it. There's steam trains, there's bridges, there's kind of hampers and picnics, and kind of, you know, running up sodden hills in the Lake District. It's kind of a pre-Brexit idyll. You know, this place, I don't think this world ever really existed except in the imagination of a few British. You know, Harry Enfield plays this kind of grumpy farmer who's always rolling his eyes at his wife, who's always threatening him with a rolling pin. It's that kind of caricature. That said, it's very charming, and it does work. In fact, I was with the kids, despite my reticence for all things outdoors. I actually kind of really liked it. I thought they were very charming, and they were very sweet, and the kids play very nicely amongst themselves, and have this kind of fertile imagination that kind of doesn't know what's going on in the adult world. And then they can't, when they do stumble on this kind of Cold War spy thing going on, they kind of thwart it in their own kind of, you know, down home way.
So the film is sort of made in an outdoor adventure out of Jason Solomon's, then, perhaps.
Maybe. I might go to a festival. I don't know. That's about as close as I get.
Okay, good. Well, that is Swallows and Amazons, which is out in the UK and Ireland today. And good news, the original 1972 version is actually has a beautiful re-release out on DVD and Blu-ray as well, if you like. Some beautiful cover art too. Now, our last film review for today, we're going on tour with one of Britain's most beloved sitcom characters since his creation back in 2001, David Brent, Life on the Road. I mean, David Brent, not exactly beloved. But look, it follows Ricky Gervais's hapless star of The Office, a mockumentary-style comedy series that saw worldwide success following the mundane lives of a sales team working in Slough. Beautiful name for a place, isn't it? In this spin-off film, Brent is back 15 years later to star in a new documentary that sees him go on a rather parochial UK tour with his band. Oh dear, foregone conclusion. Let's hear a clip first.
Hello, I'm David Brent. You probably know me as the star of the documentary The Office. I'm currently a singer-songwriter.
Oh, yeah. Here they come. Come on in. We are foregone conclusion.
And a rep.
That's as stiff as you like, and it won't damage your rug. Well, that's what I told her.
When I left Wernham Hog, I found myself again, and I started to do what I do best, entertain.
Keep the noise down.
Nah, turn it up.
Jason, look, one of the interesting differences between US sitcoms and British sitcoms is that the Brits usually know when to let it go. What's the impression here? I mean, it's been a while.
And you talk on Ricky Gervais, because The Office obviously is still going on in the US.
Indeed.
I think, you
know, the Finnish version has just been announced as well.
Right.
Rather curiously.
He spawned this monster when he made The Office, which I thought was a terrific UK comedy, classic kind of one of the best comedies of the 20th century. So it was 2000. So the 21st century then. Him and Alan Partridge, both created by Steve Coogan and Ricky Gervais, they've created these terrible characters. We're sitting here in a radio studio. We're probably closer to Partridge than we are David. But they're both cringe-making characters who put their foot in it repeatedly, dig holes that they can't get out of. They're also a hair's breadth, one senses, from the egos and ids of their creators. And hence, they stalk them like ghosts. We really don't want to see Ricky Gervais as anything else other than David Brent. Horrific, though, David Brent is. And you get the feeling that he's an albatross around his creator's neck. That if he wants to do something else and needs a money spinner, he'll have to resort to David Brent because he's such a horrific creation. What they're trying to do now is, because they're so close to their sort of original ids, is that they try and make them likable. You know, they've made these horrific monsters. This film tries to sort of see the nice side of David Brent, the kind of the sweetness in there. And there is something, there's something laudable about the way he clings on to this dream of becoming a kind of rock star. And yet, you know, he writes songs about the open road and all he can do is drive to
but
Slough.
But don't you just want to be free to despise these people? I mean, it's one of the awkward things that I think that it came out of the Absolutely Fabulous movie when they started to humanise some of the characters. And I mean, look, I know you need to do that for a feature film because otherwise, you know, what is a feature film? It's different to a 20-minute television episode. But I mean, it kind of it takes you out of your comfort zone and into some very dangerous territory.
Absolutely. The weakest points of the David Brent movie is this kind of subplot played by the excellent Joe Hartley, plays a woman from accounts who sort of has a bit of a crush on David Brent. And you think, that's just impossible. I mean, why would you? She's such a lovely actress and the character's nice. And you just feel for her kind of falling for David Brent. Maybe she can change him. That bit's the weakest. It sort of didn't work at all for me. It didn't feel believable. And it didn't make me sort of want to like David Brent. You could sense that Ricky Gervais wants you to like David Brent all the way through this movie. That's because he wants you to like Ricky Gervais, not David Brent. He would be better off kind of saying that this David Brent is a horrific creation and he should get some comeuppance, really. That's what I wanted. I don't want redemption for him. And that's sort of what the movie goes for because Ricky Gervais wrote and directed it. You know, he should have been harder on himself as a character and sort of said, where would the reality of David Brent go? That would have made this more of a movie. Because the one problem with this is that you don't need to see it in a cinema at all. The Ab Fab movie, for all its flaws, which is like a, you know, it's like a spilt handbag at dawn, is is chaotic, but it has done really good business at the cinema. It's almost 15 million here in the UK already.
I mean, because it looks very different, doesn't it? From the very opening frame, you actually see the house from the outside, which is immediately, oh, you know, this is a different. It's same, but it's different.
It's the same but different. It's all over the place. The Ab Fab. I don't make any claims for it as a great movie, but it has a. It has a reason to go to the cinema for A, because it's a raucous night out. David Brent isn't, you know, it's nothing more than a Christmas special, which he's already done. That said, it's a comedy, ultimately, and it is funny. I laughed quite a lot and sniggered quite a lot. I looked away quite a few times as well because he's just digging himself in these racist holes that he can't get out of. But sometimes they're very funny. The commitment of him and, I must say, Steve Coogan to Alan Partridge, the performance of this character is now so complete and so innate in them that it is a terrific tour de force of a performance. So that's what you're watching, a really great performance. I don't think Ricky Gervais is in any way a great actor at all. I think he's a terrible actor in anything else. But I think his David Brent is brilliant. And that's what we're watching here. And that symbiosis of creator and character coming together, and sometimes the self-loathing, you can even read it on the screen. It's like behind the eyes of the character. Should I really be doing this? Am I allowed to do this? I hate myself. Oh, I'm going to do it. Oh, it got a laugh. That's good. And that's all I've got. And the character often does that. We heard it in the clip, that it'll simper. It's like doing his own laugh because he's so panicked that it to signal that it's a laugh.
He's set a foot wrong.
Gervais
yeah.
is the same. It's a very interesting kind of nice difference and fine line there, but it's not a great movie.
David Brent, Life on the Road, some rather awkward laughs in store. You can run along and see that today, if you like, in the UK or in Ireland. And that indeed brings us to the end of today's show, thanks to my guest, Jason Solomons. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. My producer was Holly Fisher, and my researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time on Monday for our art review. But for now, thanks for listening and goodbye.